Welcome to the Busy Leaders Podcast, a catalyst for inspired action, a high-energy, high-fun podcast hosted by Quint Studer. In each high-impact segment, Quint chats with the individuals on how they're navigating today's environment. Quint and his guests showcase best practices and how they work in different contexts. You'll often walk away with tactical tools and tips that you can apply to your own role, business, community, and life. I'm Nicole Webb-Bodie, the Chief Impact Officer at Studer Family of Companies. Quint is a well-known healthcare operator, author, coach, and mentor to many. He has dedicated the last 3 decades to creating tools and techniques that make healthcare a better place for physicians to practice medicine, patients to receive care, and employees to work. He has written numerous books, articles, and his work is always based on evidence, research, and tools and techniques. For more information and to listen to previous podcasts, visit thebusyleadershandbook.com/podcasts. If you're interested in learning about our upcoming events, both virtual and in person, visit healthcareplussg.com. With stress and burnout at an all-time high, we need to be more cautious than ever about self-care. In this episode, Dr. Stephen Treziak shares how caring for and serving others actually replenishes us and shares the psychological and physical benefits of helping others. We've always known that compassion feels good to both parties. What we may not realize is there's a wealth of data proving compassion heals both parties in profound and measurable ways. Dr. Treziak's first book, Compassionomics, The Revolutionary Scientific Evidence That Caring Makes a Difference, co-authored by Dr. Anthony Mazzarelli, lays out the evidence that compassion benefits patients, care providers, and organizations. Their new book, Wonder Drug, 7 Scientifically Proven Ways That Serving Others is the Best Medicine for Yourself, reiterates that message in light of the burnout crisis and gives a specific prescription for building energy, resilience, and happiness by investing and caring in relationships. In this podcast, you'll learn why serving others is really the best medicine for yourself, how to ask the right questions and show people you really care, how to recognize the 9 opportunities for empathy each of us face every day and maximize them, how to support people through tough times even when you can't fix everything, and so much more. Stephen Treziak is a physician scientist, chief of medicine at Cooper University Healthcare, and professor and chair of medicine at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University in Camden, New Jersey. Dr. Treziak is a practicing intensivist and a clinical researcher with more than 120 publications in the scientific literature. His scientific program has been supported by research grants from the National Institutes of Health, with Dr. Treziak serving as the principal investigator. Now here's your host, Quint Studer, and our guest, Dr. Stephen Treziak.
Well, Steve, and thank you for letting me call you Steve. And this is such an honor. You know, I've told you before that your book, Compassionomics, I've used it. It's changed the industry. It's one of those game changer books. I've shown the data, because sometimes people don't connect the dots between when it's not as direct as they would like it, but you brought research to something that sometimes people didn't think they could bring research. I'm going to talk about your new book, but first of all, why don't you talk a little bit about what caused you to write that book?
Sure. So first of all, Quint, I want to thank you for having me on the show. It's an honor, and I am, you know, well aware of how you've transformed so much of the field over the last few decades in your work. So thank you. It means a lot to me to be on the show. So Compassionomics first came because we essentially asked a big question. And I'm a philosophy major. I was a philosophy major in college, Quinn. I didn't tell you that earlier. So I like asking big questions. And so the big question in Compassionomics is, does compassion really matter? And, you know, you may say, of course, compassion matters. It's the cornerstone of the art of medicine. And, you know, we ought to treat all patients with compassion. And of course, I agree. And I've always agreed. But it's a different question to ask, is compassion just in the art of medicine, or is it also in the evidence-based science of medicine? And then what is the evidence? So Dr. Maz, that's Anthony Mazzarelli, my colleague and co-author. He's co-president CEO of Cooper University Healthcare, where we are here in Camden, New Jersey. We are research nerds. We love data. And so we decided to do a journey through the evidence to try to test that hypothesis that compassion matters for patients and for patient care, and also for those who care for patients. And so after doing that and curating all the evidence that compassion could be a powerful, beneficial therapy for the giver too, that was right when I happened to be going through a burnout crisis myself. So I'm an intensivist. I practice intensive care medicine. And let me assure you, over the last 2 years, that's been quite an interesting experience. But I was keenly aware that I had every symptom of burnout myself. And what was I supposed to do? So I went to the scientific evidence. And actually, what I saw was not what I was taught in medical school. I was taught, keep a distance. You know, you need an emotional shield. Don't care too much, because too much caring will burn you out. And when you look at the scientific evidence, the evidence actually points to a different signal, that there is in fact an association between compassion and burnout, but it's inverse. It's inverse. And so that led me to the hypothesis that I can actually help my own burnout by leaning in rather than pulling back, connecting rather than detaching, caring more, not less. And that was when the fog of burnout began to lift for me. And it wasn't just compassion for patients or for their families, or it was everybody. It was my colleagues, the nurses in the ICU that I worked with for 20 years, even at home. And what the research really shows, both inside of healthcare and out, is that the key to resilience is relationships. The key to resilience is relationships. And that's what you were telling me about just as we were prepping for this show. And that's not only what you've gleaned from your decades of experience in the field, but we found also in the scientific evidence. So after that, and helping my own burnout by leaning into relationships, we published Compassionomics. We got all these letters far and wide, you know, emails, letters saying, I tested the compassion hypothesis for myself and I got the same results. And so Dr. Maz and I looked at each other and we said, there is no way that this is only true for healthcare workers. You know, it has to be a universal, something about serving others, being the best medicine for yourself. And that's where Wonder Drug came from. So we curated again another 250 original science research papers to show all of the evidence that serving other people is good for your physical health, is good for your mental health, is good for your emotional health and well-being, fulfillment, and even your professional success. And so that's how the first book and the second book, Wonder Drug, came to be.
Well, thank you. You know, I've been very involved in the recovery community, which is to keep it, you got to give it away. And I've been very involved in suicide prevention. And it's interesting because some of the things you're talking about is you talk when something you've really hard and how did you feel? And when you ask people how they got through it, invariably, they reach out to someone. They get out of that isolation, even though it's painful. You know, it's painful. They reach out to someone. So it's that whole paradox. You got to surrender to win. You got to give up. But it's so opposite of how we think. That's why it's so crazy. So we have all these listeners that are going to say, okay, I appreciate what you've done. Cause I mean, they are so grateful, because some people always thought this, but they didn't want to say it or they didn't have evidence. So you help sort of people being okay with it. But for some of the listeners, what are some practical approaches from your book, Wonder Drug, that I can put into my life, either at work or at home, if you found?
Sure. So we actually write you a prescription. And the question is then, if a doctor's prescription could bring you better health, that's physical and mental health, emotional well-being, and no side effects, would you take it, right? And so the prescription that Dr. Maz and I write in Wonder Drug is really seven evidence-based principles. And so the evidence base is, that's our go-to, because we always want to be evidence-based in everything that we do. It's just how we approach everything. We're research nerds, so that's how we do it. And specifically, we like to look at things that are familiar, but look at them in unfamiliar ways. So we'll take something in the moral ethical domain or in the emotional sentimental domain, and we'll look at it through the lens of science. and put it under the scrutiny of science. So some people might say, well, it's soft science. Well, it's only soft if you take a soft approach and you don't take the same rigorous approach that we take to studying other things that are in scientific domains. So the seven evidence-based steps of the prescription, number one, which I'm very grateful for, is start small. So you don't have to quit your job, sell all your worldly possessions, move to some third world country and start hauling water from a distant well. You just need simple prism changes. And so rather than changing your surroundings, change how you look at your surroundings and start with the people that are right in your own orbit, in your home or in your workplace, the people that we encounter every day, and look for those opportunities. Research from the University of Toronto, for example, shows that we have 9 empathy opportunities every day in regular people in everyday life, 9 empathy opportunities. So we don't have to, we don't need a major life upheaval. We just need a personal paradigm shift and to look at our opportunities around us and our surroundings and those in our orbit in a slightly different way, rather than being focusing on ourselves, to be other focused and focused on others. Number two is to be thankful. So you've probably heard that an attitude of gratitude is good for you, but the question is how? Well, research shows quite clearly, a large meta-analysis actually, that being grateful, being thankful, and most importantly for specific people, not just gratitude for like the good life I have or gratitude for the universe or something like that, but being grateful for specific people motivates you to be a more giving, other-focused person, to serve others better. And so there's research behind that as well. Number three is to be purposeful. In order to be purposeful, we have to ask the right questions. And that's what a lot of your work has been on over the years, asking the right questions rather than the wrong questions to develop those relationships. Because if we don't ask the right questions, we'll never know not only how to serve people, but we'll never even really know what they're going through. I mean, if it's one leadership principle that I've learned in my time as chair of medicine here at Cooper, I'm just consistently blown away by how much pain people carry around and we don't even know it. And so the next one, number four, is find common ground. That seems to be a more and more challenging thing in a more divided culture that we live in. It seems like there are a lot of forces working to drive us apart, when actually finding opportunities for empathy and to see the other person as the we rather than the other is vitally important. And we present the evidence for that. Number five is see it. So we have to see the effects of our serving and giving in order to fulfill the all the promise that it holds for our own well-being. And so being able to see it is really important. The last two are my favorites. Number six is elevate. And so it's all about the principle of elevation. And elevation is this concept from Jonathan Haidt and others. Their research has shown that elevation is this emotional state, this a feeling of, or this emotional state of uplift that we get every time we bear, whenever we bear witness to the goodness and the moral excellence and the heroism of other people. And the research shows quite clearly that if we have, if we surround ourselves with people that are constantly elevating us versus constantly degrading us, we will be better in serving and giving. And it's like a chain reaction or a contagion, if you will. And the last thing is to know your power. And what I mean by that is, when you meet somebody in a moment of need, whether you necessarily know how significant it is or not, but when you meet someone at just the right time with kindness or with helping or with serving, it may echo and reverberate in an echo chamber and go on and on for those people for years to come and perhaps even forever. And when you realize that you have the opportunity to for that permanence and for it to be lasting in that echo chamber and to go on and on, you think differently about the power that you hold to serve others and to meet them in that moment with kindness. And when you think differently, when you know your power, You want to use it as often as you can. So the seven evidence-based principles, Quint, are start small, be thankful, be purposeful, find common ground, see it, elevate, and lastly, know your power.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You know, and I was sitting here thinking about some simple little things and how something small, I'm with you. I think one of the problems we have in healthcare is we take something simple, we make it so complex, we can't execute it. And my cousin Al asked me one day what was going on that week. And so I gotta go. And I was telling him where I gotta go. I'm on the road. And he looked at me and said, "Why don't you use the word get to go instead of got to go?" And that's small, but you know, my 97-year-old mother lives next door to me. And if I have the mentality that I got to go see my mother, I go in with a different attitude than I get to go see my mother. So it's,
absolutely. You know, and that's being thankful and being grateful for that opportunity. When you see it as an opportunity to be grateful for, you treat it differently. You treat that visit with your mom differently. And you know its significance.
No, it's just all the stuff you're talking about. I work with two guys that are suicidal. I got both of them around the same week, about 4 years ago. It just sort of happened. One of them is a salesperson. The other one's a pretty well successful guy with lots of money. And they're both in one period told me they both were ready to take their life. And there's lots of other things that happen. But one of the things I do with those two guys is every morning, the first thing we have to send each other is a text on what we were grateful for the day before. And I'd love, with their permission, if I showed you, Steve, the 4 years of messaging, how it's changed, you can see how they've changed with these messages from eating dinner with my family to I didn't rush a conversation with my wife. It's just remarkable stuff. So for those people out there, not that there are skeptics in healthcare, but if there were a skeptic in healthcare, they'd say, "Well, this sounds really good. And, you know, I've been there," but you talk about evidence. So in the healthcare setting, if I do these things, what are some evidence that you could show that either I'm going to be healthier or some of the results I'm trying to get in my organization will be a little bit better?
Sure. So we curated the scientific evidence first in Compassionomics through a quasi-systematic review, 280 original science research papers, and with Wonder Drug, again, 250 original science research papers. Now, for you know, most people don't want to read 250 research papers, but that's why we synthesized it for you. And we present it in a way that's accessible to anybody, even if you have no research background whatsoever. But our standards for evaluating evidence as it relates to serving others is no different than the standards of evidence of any pill you might have taken from your medicine drawer today, or any surgery that perhaps has been recently recommended to you. And so as it relates to physical health, what the research shows is that kinder people not only live better, they also live longer. And so there are numerous studies that show that people who volunteer to serve others have more longevity and lower risk of mortality over time. And those data are pretty clear. One of the things that sometimes you might be concerned about is something called residual confounding. So that's just a research term for, yeah, they adjusted the analyses in these studies for all the things that they could measure, but there could be a lot of things that they don't routinely measure or can't measure that might actually be influencing the results and screwing everything up. Like, for example, what if the people who didn't serve others also ate way too much junk food or live next to a toxic waste dump or something like that, right? Couldn't that screw up the evidence? Well, researchers from the International Journal of Epidemiology wanted to assess this. So what they did is they enrolled a huge number of married couples cohabitating. So married couples living in the same house. So same address, same dinner, probably the same friends, same geography, all of that. And what they found after, again, adjusting for all the factors that could be measured, what they found is the spouse who serves others gets a longevity benefit. But the other spouse who doesn't, who lives in the same house, eats the same dinner, has the same friends, does not. So it's not the drapes and it's not something in the water. What the evidence points to is that there's something about serving others that is actually beneficial to your physical health in such a way that it actually increases longevity. And I could tell you all about, you know, like biological effects of the reasons why serving others has a physiological basis. But the evidence is that we can even live longer, among a myriad of other findings that we report in the book. As it relates to serving your organization, and you've served organizations for a long time now, and you know firsthand the experience of how organizations do better when not only do the frontline people have the heart of a servant, but also the leaders practice servant leadership. And in addition, the evidence also points to it's also good for yourself. Not that it should be all about you, but you become a better leader when you serve others. And that's not just my belief or my opinion or what I think, but it's what the research shows. So the research actually shows that if you're a ruthless tyrant kind of boss trying to move up the ladder, so to speak, you'll get arrows in your back pretty quick. But it's the people who are what we call the live to givers in the workplace, who everybody cheers for when they do well and have successes. Those are the people on average that will actually achieve positions of power. I'm thinking about a study from Cal Berkeley, which found that people who are aggressive, ruthless types do not achieve positions of power less effectively than people who are the giving, generous types. And so, you know, we might picture an aggressive boss, you know, like, I'm trying to think of the guy from The Simpsons. I can't think of his name right now, but you know who I'm thinking about, right? So we might have that picture in our minds, but the truth is that it's going to be tough for those people to achieve a position of influence because they don't build up the idiosyncrasy credits over the years of doing right by everybody and everyone else knowing that they have their best interest at heart.
We're talking, Steve, as we're, you know, getting ready for this. I shared with you some of my concerns that we've taken what I would call leadership was about relationships. You know, I talked about early on when I was at just starting this work, we sort of made it pretty simple. We'd said to an employee, is this a good place for you to work today? We said to a patient, are you getting excellent care? To a doctor, yeah, we need to practice medicine. And it was really meant to be transforming relationships, to take that old paradigm of you work for me, but no, my job is to create the right culture for you to work in. And maybe it's just me, but maybe I'm just to that age where I'm talking about what we used to, or the good old days. However, one of my concerns is leadership has become, we've almost made it transactional. You know, check this box, hit this software. And I get it. I get why we have to document things for patients. I really do. But I think we've almost taken it where we're trying to document everything for everybody to everything. And I'm probably guilty too. I'm going to speak at a place the other day in a couple of weeks and they're excited to have me, but somebody said, oh my God, are we going to have to document how many thank you notes we're writing again? And the answer is no. The answer is no. So talk a little bit about You know, serving is not transactional, it's transformational. And my thing is we've sort of drifted into this trap of transactional leadership, and we need to, in your book, Wonder Drug and Help and Compassionomics did, get back into transformational leadership. What are your thoughts on that?
I love your comments, and your focus on relationships is really what it's all about. So I'll just tell you a quick story. So in my leadership experience, and I've been the chair of medicine for about 5 years here at Cooper, and was the head of critical care medicine before that. And what I have found is I mentioned this a little bit earlier, I'm consistently just blown away by what kind of pain people are carrying around. And so one of the things that I mentioned earlier as part of the evidence-based prescription and Wonder Drug is be purposeful. And so part of that is asking the right questions and asking the right, you know, here's the wrong question. You doing good? Okay. Yeah. All good? Yeah. Right. So that just invites the response, you know, that just invites the belief that you can't be bothered.
But it's always good too, when you ask those questions, Steve, to keep walking. You don't want to slow down. You want to round asking those questions while you keep moving. So if there is an answer you don't like, you've already down the hall a little bit.
Well, I actually think, maybe this applies to everybody, but physicians specifically like to be fixers. That's just kind of how physicians are wired, and you're trained to make a diagnosis and then try your best to fix it. So physicians like to try to be fixers. It's maybe, how they're trained, but asking the right questions can then sometimes be a little intimidating because you might get an answer that you can't necessarily fix. And so what I try to tell people, so let me give you an example. So I invited a physician to come in for a chat, and this physician, I think the physician thought they were coming into the principal's office or something when they came into my office, right? And that's definitely not what I had in mind. And so we sat down and shut the door, and I said, "Look, you don't have to say anything. I only want you to know one thing. I've known you for like a long time. It was almost 20 years, right? I said, I've known you for a long time, and I'm seeing this, and that's not like you. And I just want you to know I'm worried about you. All I want you to know is I'm worried about you. And if you want to talk about it, I'm not going anywhere, right? And when you ask those questions, I'm just blown away by what's front of mind for people. Things like, well, I just got a really bad diagnosis and nobody knows, right? Or my home life is falling apart. My kids won't talk to me, whatever. It could be other things. I've heard some really heavy stuff when I invite people in and close the door. And I know that I can't necessarily fix that, right? But I can support them through those things, right? And so, for example, for one of the examples I'm thinking about, the physician had a really bad diagnosis and is a very, very private person. And it was just crucial for this physician that no one knew. And it's not for me to judge. That's up to them. So I was able to build a support structure around what this physician needed to do their leadership job. And until a couple years later, when the physician realized that they couldn't do their job up to their very high standards for themselves, and I was able to help that physician exit the organization with dignity. And to this day, we have a relationship, that we never had before. And so that is actually, for a leadership moment, that is actually one of the things I'm most proud of of what I've done over the last 5 years. And nobody in my organization knows it even happened. Nobody. And no, so you have to be willing to ask the questions, but don't feel like you always have to be able to fix it. I learned this from a pastor years ago. A pastor friend of mine who's now retired made a lot of sick visits in the hospital. And I asked him about, how, you know, my, as an ICU doctor, I have those visits as well in the hospital, but they're different. They're clinical. And, you know, I try to connect with compassion and show compassion whenever I can. The pastoral visit is a little bit different. And what he told me is that he just likes to sit with people in their suffering. Because, and he always said, don't feel the need to fill the silence. Just let the silence be there. Don't feel the need to fill it, because just being there, your presence is meaningful in and of itself, because it says, I can't change the circumstances, but I'm not going anywhere. And so just presence is really important. So I tell this story sometimes, especially to my medical students and residents and fellows, because if you don't ask the right questions, you'll never know really what people are carrying around, but you don't need to feel, you don't have to be a fixer.
I think that's one of the hardest things for someone in leadership to not do, is not fix. I think, you know, I used to say one of the hardest things to do in leadership is say things like, what do you think? What do you recommend? Any thoughts? Because we're trained to fix. And I'll tell my own personal story here. Nothing as dramatic as yours, but my wife, I came home one day and she just mentioned, she wondered if the landscapers had been by. Well, I immediately got on the phone, called the landscaper and asked if they'd been by. I hung up and I waited for her to thank me for being so, you know, fast and responsive. And she said, why did you do that? I said, you told me you were wondering if the landscaper was here. She said, I didn't tell you to call anybody. Mm-hmm. I just wanted you to listen to me. And not that that compares to you, but I'm like choked up here, Nicole Webb Bodie. I always watch Nicole Webb Bodie and can see, you know, what I can tell how much she's enjoying these. And one, is she crying? And two, is she writing? And she's been crying and writing at the same time here for the last half hour.
Can I give you another one, Quint? Another question?
Please.
So I know there are a lot of different ways to get to the right information, but I know that a huge proportion of your audience are healthcare leaders. And so going back to, you know, the right questions to ask, there's a study, we think it's so important, we actually covered it not only in Compassionomics briefly, but we covered it in more detail in the new book, Wonder Drug. But there was a study from the University of Colorado where they studied patients in the emergency department, and they handed them cards to write on. And the card had one question on it. And the question is, what worries you the most? What worries you the most? And then what they did is they compared the greatest worry from the patient perspective while they were waiting to the chief complaint that was written on the emergency department record by the triage nurse who did the intake when the patient arrived in the emergency department. And what they found is that the greatest worry and the chief complaint were only concordant, meaning they matched up perfectly, 26% of the time. 74% of the time, there was something totally different. So, for example, one of the cases that they showed as an example was a middle-aged man whose chief complaint was chest pain. His greatest worry is, I can't stay out of the hospital. I know it's because I went back to the drugs, and I'm afraid I'm going to lose my family, right? And so if you didn't know that the addiction was actually the greatest worry, you'd never address it. You'd just be running cardiac enzymes, EKG, maybe call the cardiologist. You wouldn't have any idea how to really help in that moment. Then they gave another example where the chief complaint on the emergency department record was first trimester vaginal bleeding. So a pregnant woman, and the greatest worry in the study was depression. And she wrote, depression. I don't want to go back into depression again. Having a miscarriage is so hard. And so if you didn't know that, all you would do is run the tests, do the ultrasound, do the, and so as a result of this research, right? And some, I know these are stories, but this is actually a research study, right? With data, 26% concordance. So I now practice this. And what I mean by that, we always want to practice evidence-based medicine, right? In everything we do. And I'm an intensivist. So in the ICU, I want to practice evidence-based medicine and use the latest evidence to guide the therapies that I recommend. And so I'll be, you know, many of my patients can't actually talk to me because they're on a ventilator, or they're in a coma, but I, of course, can talk to the families. And after talking to the families, and we'll be getting to the end, or with what is what I conventionally, for the first 20 years of my career, thought was the end of the conversation, then I would just pause and ask the question. I just have one more question. What worries you the most? Quint, I am blown away by what is front of mind for people that I literally have had no idea. And sometimes it's something I can easily address, and I can literally help, you know, hopefully allay their greatest fear in that moment. Sometimes not. Sometimes it's much more complicated, but I understand what's going on in that room on a totally different level. And it's just asking the right question. Do you have any other questions? Was the wrong question for the first 20 years of my life, because it invites a no, right? What worries you the most opens it up to just, wow. I used to think that, you know, nothing could surprise me after 20 years of working in the ICU, but now I'm routinely surprised when I ask that question.
Well, I think, Steve, as we wrap up here, you know, knowing you and really knowing all of us at the Gratitude Group, we're all sort of very similarity. We have different skills, different interests, but if you look at the, encourage people to go to www.thegratitudegroup.com to listen to the presentation, is we're all trying to make healthcare better. That's really what we're doing. We're all trying to make healthcare better. And that's certainly what you've done and continue to do. And I'm just so thrilled to know you. And we have a conference coming up called Replenish Yourself, Your Team, and Your Organization, June 21st and 22nd. I'm trying to disrupt healthcare, Steve. I think we've made conferences way too expensive that middle managers can't attend them anymore. So we are charging $300 in person and $250 virtual. And if you can't afford it, let us know. We got scholarships, because it does no good to have a conference if people can't attend them and go on. And we just want to carry the message out. And one of the nice parts about this conference is you're going to make an appearance. It's going to be virtual, but you're going to make an appearance. And we also know that we are doing everything we can to get, because your book comes out June 22nd, I believe, and we're doing everything we can to get enough copies. So anyone that comes to the conference is going to get, like, I mean, the print will still be, we'll have to like breathe on them, because the print will still be wet when we get these. So we're excited, Steve. We're excited to work with you. I know we've got a whole bunch of other things we're trying to do together to really address this whole idea of human capital. And it's sort of neat, because I'm seeing it happen. I'm seeing it. People more and more are just learning from Compassionomics, now learn from Wonder Drug, just what you've taught us today. And I love the fact you've given us tools. I love the fact that you've given us things to do. Because sometimes, you know, we want to do it, but we don't know how. I don't think it's ever a want. I think it's the how. So on behalf of, I know, everyone listening and so many people in healthcare, just thank you for what you're doing to make healthcare better and what you've done to make healthcare better.
Well, Quint, thank you so much. I want to thank you and Nicole for having me on the show. And if anybody can disrupt healthcare, it's you guys. So
that's the goal. That's the goal. But thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Busy Leaders Podcast, a catalyst for inspired action, hosted by Quint Studer. Please subscribe, rate us, and write a review. For more information, visit thebusyleadershandbook.com.